and Will would come upstairs and talk to Liam while he had his bath, maybe get to the bottom of the Marcus problem, while Tess cooked a stir-fry for dinner. She had the ingredients ready. It was too bizarre, thinking of the little plastic-wrapped tray of chicken strips sitting staidly in the refrigerator. Surely she and Will were still going to have a glass of that half-empty bottle of wine and talk about potential men for the brand new beautiful Felicity. They'd already canvassed so many possibilities. Their Italian bank manager. The big quiet guy who owned their local deli. Never once had Will slapped his hand to his forehead and said, "Of course, how could I have missed it? Me? I'd be perfect for her." It was a joke. She couldn't stop thinking that the whole thing was a joke. "We know nothing can make this easy, or right, or better," said Will. "But we'll do whatever you want. Whatever you think is right for you and for Liam." "For Liam," repeated Tess, dumbstruck. For some reason, it hadn't occurred to her that Liam would have to be told about this, that Liam would have anything to do with it or be in any way affected. Liam, who was upstairs right now, lying on his stomach, watching television, his little six-year-old mind filled with giant-sized worries of Marcus. "No," she thought. "No, no, no, absolutely not." She saw her mother appearing at her bedroom door. "Daddy and I want to talk to you about something." It would not happen to Liam the way it had happened to her. Over her dead body. Her beautiful, grave-faced little boy would not feel the loss and confusion she'd felt that awful summer all those years ago. He would not pack a little overnight bag every second Friday. He would not have to check a calendar on the refrigerator to see where he was sleeping each weekend. He would not learn to think before he spoke whenever one parent asked a seemingly innocuous question about the other. Her mind raced. All that mattered now was Liam. Her own feelings were irrelevant. How could she say this? How could she stop it? "We never, ever meant for this to happen." Will's eyes were big and guileless. "And we want to do this the right way. The best way for all of us. We even wondered..." Tess saw Felicity shake her head slightly at Will. "You'd even wondered what?" said Tess. Here was more evidence of their talking. She could imagine the enjoyable intensity of these conversations. Teary eyes demonstrating what good people they were, how they were suffering at the thought of hurting Tess. But what choice did they have in the face of their passion, their love? "It's too soon to talk about what we're going to do." Felicity's voice was firmer suddenly. Tess's fingernails dug into her palms. How dare she? How dare she talk in her normal voice, as if this was a normal situation, a normal problem? "You even wondered what?" Tess kept her eyes on Will. "Forget about Felicity," she told herself. "You don't have time to feel angry. Think, Tess, think." Will's face went from white to red. "Well, we wondered if it would be possible for all of us to live together. Here. For Liam's sake. It's not like this is a normal breakup. We're all family. So that's why we thought, I mean, maybe it's crazy, but we just thought it might be possible. Eventually." Tess guffawed, a hard, almost guttural sound. Were they out of their minds? "You mean, I just move out of my bedroom and Felicity moves in? So we just say to Liam, 'Don't worry, honey, Daddy sleeps with Felicity now and Mummy is in the spare room.' Felicity looked mortified. Of course not. When you put it like that, began Will. But what other way is there to put it? Will exhaled. He leaned forward. Look, he said, we don't need to work anything out right this second. Sometimes Will used a particularly masculine, reasonable but authoritative tone in the office when he wanted things done a certain way. Tess and Felicity gave him absolute hell about it. He was using that tone now, as if it were time to get things under control. How dare he? Tess lifted her closed fists and slammed them down so hard on the table that it rattled. She'd never done such a thing before. It felt farcical and absurd and somewhat thrilling. She was pleased to see both Will and Felicity flinch. I'll tell you what's going to happen, Tess said, because all at once it was perfectly clear. It was simple. Will and Felicity needed to have a proper affair. The sooner the better. This smouldering thing they had going had to run its course. At the moment, it was sweet and sexy. They were star-crossed lovers, Romeo and Juliet gazing soulfully at each other over the purple cough-stop dragon. It needed to get sweaty and sticky and sleazy and eventually, hopefully, God willing, banal and dull. Will loved his son, and once the fog of lust cleared, he'd see that he'd made a ghastly but not irretrievable mistake. This could all be fixed. The only way forward was for Tess to leave. Right now. Liam and I will go and stay in Sydney, she said. With Mum. She called just a minute ago to say she's broken her ankle. She needs someone there to help her. Oh no, how? Is she okay? Said Felicity. Tess ignored her. Felicity didn't get to be the caring niece anymore. She was the other woman. Tess was the wife, and she was going to fight this, for Liam's sake. She would fight it, and she would win. We'll stay with her until her ankle is better. But Tess, you can't take Liam to live in Sydney. Will's bossy tone vanished. He was a Melbourne boy. There had never been any question that they would live anywhere else. He looked at Tess with a wounded expression, as if he were Liam being unjustly told off for something. Then his brow cleared. What about school? He said. He can't miss school. He can go to St. Angela's for a term. He needs to get away from Marcus. This will be good for him. A complete change of scenery. He can walk to school like I did. You wouldn't be able to get him in, said Will frantically. He's not Catholic. Who says he's not Catholic? Said Tess. He's baptized in the Catholic Church. Felicity opened her mouth and shut it again. I'll get him in, said Tess. She had no idea how hard it would be to get him in. Mum knows people at the church. As Tess spoke, images of St. Angela's, the tiny local Catholic school she and Felicity had both attended, filled her head. Playing hopscotch in the shadows of the church spires. The sound of church bells. The sweet, rotting smell of forgotten bananas in the bottom of school bags. It was a 5-minute walk from Tess's mother's home. The school was at the end of a tree-lined cul-de-sac, and in summer, the trees formed a canopy overhead like a cathedral. It was autumn now, still warm enough to swim in Sydney. The leaves of the liquid ambers would be green and gold. Liam would walk through puddles of pale pink rose petals on uneven footpaths. Some of Tess's old teachers were still at St. Angela's. Kids who Tess and Felicity had been at school with had grown up and turned into mums and dads who sent their own children there. Tess's mother mentioned their names sometimes, and Tess could never quite believe they still existed. Like the gorgeous Fitzpatrick boys. Six blonde, square-jawed boys who were so similar they looked like they'd been purchased in bulk. They were so good-looking, Tess used to blush whenever one of them walked by. One of the altar boys was always a Fitzpatrick. Each of them left St. Angela's in year four and went off to that exclusive Catholic boys' school on the harbour. They were wealthy as well as gorgeous. Apparently, the eldest Fitzpatrick boy now had three daughters who were all at St. Angela's. Could she really do it? Take Liam to Sydney and send him to her old primary school? It felt impossible, like she was trying to send him back through time to her childhood. For a moment, she felt dizzy again. This wasn't happening. Of course she couldn't take Liam out of school. His sea creature project was due on Friday. He had little athletics on Saturday. She had a load of washing ready to go on the line, and a potential new client to see first thing tomorrow morning. But she saw that Will and Felicity were exchanging glances again, and her heart twisted. She looked at her watch. It was 6:30 p.m. From upstairs, she could hear the theme music for that unbearable show, The Biggest Loser. Liam must have switched off his DVD and changed it over to normal TV. In a minute, he'd flick the channel looking for something with guns. "You get nothing for nothing," shouted someone from the television set. Tess hated the empty motivational phrases they used on that show. "I'll get us on a flight tonight," she said. "Tonight?" said Will. "You can't take Liam on a flight tonight." "Yes, I can. There'll be a 9 p.m. flight. We'll make it easily." "Tess," Felicity said, "this is over the top. You really don't need to..." "We'll get out of your way," said Tess, "so you and Will can sleep together. Finally." "Take my bed. I changed the sheets this morning." Other things came into her head. Far worse things, she could say. To Felicity. "He likes you on top. So lucky you lost all that weight." To Will, "Don't look too closely at all the stretch marks." But no, they were the ones who should be feeling as sordid as a roadside motel. She stood up and smoothed down the front of her skirt. "So that's that. You'll just have to deal with the agency without me. Tell the clients there's been a family emergency." There certainly had been a family emergency. She went to pick up the row of Felicity's half-full coffee cups, linking her fingers through as many handles as she could. Then she changed her mind, put the cups back down, and while Will and Felicity watched, she carefully selected the two fullest cups, lifted them up in the palms of her hands, and with a netballer's careful aim, threw cold coffee straight at their stupid, earnest, sorry faces. Chapter 3. Rachel had thought they were going to tell her that they were having another baby. That's what made it so much worse. As soon as they'd walked into the house, she'd known there was big news. They'd had the self-conscious, smug expressions of people who know they are about to make you sit up and listen. Rob had been talking more than usual. Lauren had been talking less than usual. Only Jacob had been his normal self, tearing through the house this way and that, flinging open the cupboards and drawers where he knew Rachel kept little treasure troves of toys and things she thought might interest him. Of course, Rachel never asked Lauren or Rob if they had something they wanted to tell her. She wasn't that sort of grandma. Not her. She took meticulous care when Lauren visited to be the perfect mother-in-law. Caring, but not cloying. Interested, but not nosy. She never criticized or even made so much as a suggestion about Jacob, not even to Rob when he was on his own, because she knew how much worse it would be for Lauren to hear. "Mum says..." This wasn't easy. A steady stream of suggestions ran silently through her head like those snippets of news that run along the bottom of the TV on CNN. For one thing, the child needed a haircut. Were the two of them blind that they hadn't noticed the way Jacob kept blowing his hair out of his eyes? Also, the fabric of that dreadful Thomas the Tank shirt was much too scratchy on his skin. If he was wearing it on the day she had him, she always took it off and dressed him in a nice old soft T-shirt and then madly redressed him when they were coming up the driveway. But what good had it done her? All her careful mother-in-lawing. She may as well have been the mother-in-law from hell. Because they were leaving and taking Jacob with them as if they had every right. Which they did, she guessed. Technically. There was no new baby. Lauren had been offered a job. A wonderful job in New York. It was a 2-year contract. They told her at the dinner table when they were having dessert. Sara Lee apple custard turnover and ice cream. From their breathless elation, you'd think Lauren had been offered a job in bloody paradise. Jacob was sitting on Rachel's lap when they told her. His solid, square little body melting against hers with the divine limpness of a tired toddler. Rachel was breathing in the scent of his hair, her lips against the little dip in the center of his neck. When she had first held Jacob in her arms and pressed her mouth to his tender, fragile scalp, it had felt as though she was being brought back to life, like a wilting plant being watered. His new baby scent had filled her lungs with oxygen. She'd actually felt her spine straighten, as if someone had finally released her from a heavy weight she'd been forced to carry for years. When she'd walked out into the hospital car park, she'd been able to see colour seeping back into the world. "We're hoping you'll come and visit us," said Lauren. Lauren was a career woman. She worked for the Commonwealth Bank, doing something very high up and stressful and important. She earned more than Rob. This wasn't a secret. In fact, Rob seemed proud of it, mentioning it more than seemed necessary. If Ed had ever heard his son showing off about his wife's pay packet, he would have curled up and died. So it was lucky that he had, well, curled up and died. Rachel had also worked for the Commonwealth Bank before she got married, although this coincidence had never come up in their conversations about Lauren's work. Rachel didn't know if her son had forgotten this fact about his mother's life, or never knew it, or just didn't find it that interesting. Of course, Rachel understood very well that her little bank job, the one she gave up as soon as she got married, bore no similarity to Lauren's career. Rachel couldn't conceive what Lauren actually did each day. All she knew was that it was something to do with project management. You would think someone so good at project management could manage the project of packing a bag for Jacob when he came to stay the night, but apparently not. Lauren always seemed to forget something essential. No more nights with Jacob. No more bath time. No more stories. No more dancing to the Wiggles in the living room. It felt like he was dying. She had to remind herself that he was still alive, sitting right here on her lap. "Yeah. You've got to come and see us in New York City, Mum," said Rob. He sounded like he already had an American accent. His teeth caught the light as he smiled at his mother. Those teeth had cost Ed and Rachel a small fortune. Rob's strong, straight piano key teeth would be right at home in America. "Get yourself your first ever passport, Mum. You could even see a bit of America if you wanted. Go on one of those bus tours, or, I know, do one of those Alaskan cruises." She wondered sometimes whether, if their lives hadn't been divided so cleanly as if by a giant wall, before the 6th of April 1984, after the 6th of April 1984, Rob would have grown up differently. Not quite so relentlessly upbeat. Not quite so much like a real estate agent. Mind you, he was a real estate agent, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise when he behaved like one. "I want to do one of those Alaskan cruises," said Lauren. She put her hand over Rob's. "I've always imagined us doing one when we're old and grey." Then she coughed, probably because she remembered that Rachel was old and grey. "It certainly would be interesting." Rachel took a sip of her tea. "Maybe a little chilly." Were they mad? Rachel did not want to do an Alaskan cruise. She wanted to sit on the back step in the sunshine and blow bubbles for Jacob in the backyard and watch him laugh. She wanted to see him grow, week by week. And she wanted them to have another baby. Soon. Lauren was 39. Just last week, Rachel had told Marla that there was plenty of time for Lauren to have another baby. They had them so late these days, she'd said. But that was when she'd secretly thought there was going to be an announcement any minute. In fact, she'd been planning for that second baby. Just like an ordinary, interfering mother-in-law. She had decided that when the baby came, she'd retire. She loved her job at St. Angela's, but in 2 years, she'd be 70. 70. And she was getting tired. Looking after 2 children 2 days a week would be enough for her. She'd assumed that this was her future. She could almost feel the weight of the new baby in her arms. Why didn't the damned girl want another baby? Didn't they want to give Jacob a little brother or sister? What was so special about New York, with all those beeping horns and steam billowing oddly from holes in the street? For Pete's sake, the girl went back to work 3 months after Jacob was born. It wasn't like having a baby would be that big an inconvenience for her. If someone had asked Rachel that morning about her life, she would have said that it was full and satisfying. She looked after Jacob on Mondays and Fridays, and the rest of the time he was in daycare, while Lauren sat at her desk in the city, managing her projects. When Jacob was at daycare, Rachel worked at St. Angela's as the school secretary. She had her work, her gardening, her friend Marla, her stack of library books, and 2 whole precious days a week with her grandson. Jacob often stayed overnight with her on the weekend, too, so that Rob and Lauren could go out. They liked going out, those two, to their fancy restaurants, the theatre and the opera. Do you mind? Ed would have guffawed over that. If someone had asked, "Are you happy?" she would have said, "I'm as happy as I can be." She had no idea that her life was so flimsily constructed, like a stack of cards, and that Rob and Lauren could march in here on a Monday night and cheerfully help themselves to the one card that mattered. Remove the Jacob card, and her life collapsed, floated softly to the ground. Rachel pressed her lips to Jacob's head, and tears filled her eyes. Not fair. Not fair. Not fair. 2 years will go so quickly, said Lauren, her eyes on Rachel. Like this, Rob clicked his fingers. For you, thought Rachel. Or we might not even stay the full 2 years, said Lauren. Then again, you might end up staying for good, said Rachel, with a big bright smile, to show that she was a woman of the world and she knew how these things worked. She thought of the Russell twins, Lucy and Mary, and how both their daughters had gone to live in Melbourne. They'll end up staying there, Lucy had said sadly to Rachel one Sunday after church. It was years and years ago, but it had stuck in Rachel's head, because Lucy had been right. The last Rachel had heard the cousins, Lucy's shy little girl and Mary's plump daughter with the beautiful eyes, were still in Melbourne and were there for good. But Melbourne was a hop, skip and a jump away. You could fly to Melbourne for the day if you wanted. Lucy and Mary did it all the time. You couldn't fly to New York for the day. And then there were people like Virginia Fitzpatrick, who job-shared, in a manner of speaking, the school secretary's position with Rachel. Virginia had 6 sons and 14 grandchildren, and most of them lived within a 20-minute radius on Sydney's North Shore. If one of Virginia's children decided to go to New York, she probably wouldn't even notice she had so many grandchildren to spare. Rachel should have had more children. She should have been a good Catholic wife and mother and had at least 6. But no, she hadn't, because of her vanity, because she'd secretly thought she was special, different from all those other women. God knows exactly how she'd thought she was special. Wasn't like she'd had any specific aspirations of career or travel or whatever. Not like girls did these days. "When do you leave?" Rachel said to Lauren and Rob as Jacob slid from her lap unexpectedly and bolted into the living room on one of his urgent missions. A moment later she heard the sound of the television start-up. The clever little thing had worked out how to use the remote control. "Not till August," said Lauren. "We've got lots to sort out, visas and so on. We'll have to find an apartment, a nanny for Jacob." A nanny for Jacob. "Job for me." Rob sounded a little nervous. "Oh, yes, darling," said Rachel. She did try to take her son seriously. She really did. "A job for you. In real estate, do you think?" "Not sure yet," said Rob. "We'll have to see. I might end up being a house husband." "So sorry I never taught him how to cook," said Rachel to Lauren. Not especially sorry. Rachel had never been much interested in cooking, or that good at it. It was just another chore that had to be done, like the laundry. The way people went on these days about cooking. "That's okay," beamed Lauren. "We'll probably eat out a lot in New York. The city that never sleeps, you know." "Although, of course, Jacob will need to sleep," said Rachel. "Or will the nanny feed him while you're out for dinner?" Lauren's smile wavered, and she glanced at Rob, who was oblivious, of course. The volume of the television suddenly increased, so the house boomed with cinematic sound. A male voice shouted, "You get nothing for nothing!" Rachel recognized the voice. It was one of the trainers on The Biggest Loser. She liked that show. She found it soothing to get caught up in a brightly coloured plastic world where all that mattered was how much you ate and exercised, where pain and anguish were suffered over no greater tragedy than push-ups, where people spoke intensely about calories and sobbed joyfully over lost kilos. And then they all lived happily, skinnily, ever after. "You playing with the remote again, Jake?" called out Rob over the noise of the TV. He left the table and went into the living room. He was always the first to get up and go to Jacob. Never Lauren. Right from the beginning, he'd changed nappies. Ed had never changed a nappy in his life. Of course, all the daddies changed nappies these days. It probably didn't hurt them. It just made Rachel feel awkward, almost embarrassed, as if they were doing something inappropriate, too feminine. How the girls of today would shriek if she was to ever admit to that. "Rachel," said Lauren. Rachel saw that Lauren was looking at her nervously, as if she had a large favour to ask. "Yes, Lauren, I'll take care of Jacob while you and Rob live in New York. For 2 years? No problem. Off you go. Have a lovely time." "This Friday," said Lauren, Good Friday. I know that it's, the anniversary. Rachel froze. Yes, she said in her chilliest voice. Yes, it is. She had no desire to discuss this Friday with Lauren, of all people. Her body had known weeks ago that Friday was coming up. It happened every year in the last days of summer, when she felt that very first hint of crispness in the air. She'd feel a tension in her muscles, a prickling sense of horror, and then she'd remember. Of course. Here comes another autumn. A pity. She used to love autumn. I understand that you go to the park, said Lauren, as if they were discussing the venue for an upcoming cocktail party. It's just that I wondered... Rachel couldn't bear it. Would you mind if we didn't talk about it? Just not right now. Another time? Of course. Lauren flushed, and Rachel felt a pang of guilt. She rarely played that card. It made her feel cheap. I'll make us a cup of tea, she said, and began to stack the plates. Let me help. Lauren half stood. Leave that, ordered Rachel. If you're sure. Lauren pushed a lock of strawberry blonde hair behind her ear. She was a pretty girl. The first time Rob had brought her home to meet Rachel, he'd barely been able to contain his pride. It had reminded her of his rosy, plump face when he'd brought home a new painting from preschool. What had happened to their family in 1984 should have made Rachel love her son even more. But it didn't. It was like she'd lost her ability to love until Jacob was born. By then, she and Rob had developed a relationship that was perfectly nice, but it was like that dreadful carob chocolate. As soon as you tasted it, you knew it was just a wrong, sad imitation. So Rob had every right to take Jacob away from her. She deserved it, for not loving him enough. This was her penance. 200 Hail Marys and your grandson goes to New York. There was always a price, and Rachel always had to pay it in full. No discounts. Just like she'd paid for her mistake in 1984. Rob was making Jacob giggle now, wrestling with him probably, hanging him upside down by his ankles, the same way Ed used to wrestle with him. "Here comes the tickle monster!" cried Rob. Peal after peal of Jacob's laughter floated into the room like streams of bubbles, and Rachel and Lauren both laughed together. It was irresistible, like they were being tickled themselves. Their eyes met across the table, and at that instant, Rachel's laughter turned into a sob. Oh, Rachel. Lauren half rose from her seat and reached out a perfectly manicured hand. She had a manicure, a pedicure, and a massage every third Saturday. She called it Lauren time. Rob brought Jacob over to Rachel's place, whenever it was Lauren time, and they walked to the park on the corner and ate egg sandwiches. I'm so sorry. I know how much you'll miss Jacob, but... Rachel took a deep, shaky breath and pulled herself together with all the strength that she had, as if she were heaving herself back up from a cliff edge. Don't be silly, she said so sharply that Lauren flinched and dropped back into her seat. I'll be fine. This is a wonderful opportunity for you all. She began stacking their dessert plates, roughly scraping leftover Sara Lee into a messy, unappealing pile of food. By the way, she said, just before she left the room, that child needs a haircut. Chapter 4. John Paul? Are you there? Cecilia pressed the phone so hard to her ear that it hurt. Finally, he spoke. Have you opened it? His voice was thin and reedy, like a querulous old man in a nursing home. No, said Cecilia. You're not dead, so I thought I'd better not. She'd been trying for a flippant tone, but she sounded shrill, as if she was nagging him. There was silence again. She heard someone with an American accent call out, Sir! This way, sir! Hello, said Cecilia.
Could you please not open it? Would you mind? I wrote it a long time ago, when Isabel was a baby, I think. It's sort of embarrassing. I thought I'd lost it, actually. Where did you find it?
He sounded self-conscious, as if he was talking to her in front of people he didn't know that well. Are you with someone? Asked Cecilia.
No, I'm just having breakfast here in the hotel restaurant.
I found it when I was in the attic, looking for my piece of the Berlin... Anyway, I knocked over one of your shoeboxes, and there it was.
I must have been doing my taxes around the same time as I wrote it, said John Paul. What an idiot. I remember I looked and looked for it. I thought I was losing my mind. I couldn't believe I would lose.
His voice faded. Well, he sounded so contrite, so full of what seemed like excessive remorse. Well, that doesn't matter. Now she sounded motherly, like she was talking to one of the girls. But what made you write it in the first place?
Just an impulse. I guess I was all emotional. Our first baby. It got me thinking about my dad and the things he didn't get to say after he died. Things left unsaid. All the cliches. It just says sappy stuff. About how much I love you. Nothing earth-shattering. I can't really remember, to be honest.
So why can't I open it then? She put on a wheedling voice that slightly sickened her. What's the big deal? Silence again.
It's not a big deal, but Cecilia, please. I'm asking you not to open it.
He sounded quite desperate. For heaven's sake, what a fuss. Men were so ridiculous about emotional stuff. Fine, I won't open it. Let's hope I don't get to read it for another 50 years.
Unless I outlast you.
No chance. You eat too much red meat. I bet you're eating bacon right now.
And I bet you fed those poor girls fish tonight, didn't you?
He was making a joke, but he still sounded tense.
Is that Daddy? Polly skidded into the room. I need to talk to him urgently.
Here's Polly, said Cecilia, as Polly attempted to pull the phone from her grasp.
Polly, stop it. Just a moment. Talk to you tomorrow. Love you.
Love you too,
she heard him say, as Polly grabbed the phone. She ran from the room, with it pressed to her ear.
Daddy, listen. I need to tell you something. And it's quite a big secret.
Polly loved secrets. She hadn't stopped talking about them or sharing them ever since she'd learned of their existence at the age of 2.
Let your sister talk to him too,
called out Cecilia. She picked up her cup of tea and placed the letter next to her, squaring it up with the edge of the table. So that was that. Nothing to worry about. She would file it away and forget about it. He'd been embarrassed. That was all. It was sweet. Of course, now she'd promised not to open it, she couldn't. It would have been better not to have mentioned it. She'd finish her tea and make a start on that slice. She pulled Esther's book about the Berlin Wall over, flipped the pages, and stopped at a photo of a young boy with an angelic, serious face that reminded her a little of John Paul, the way he'd looked as a young man when she'd first fallen in love with him. John Paul had always taken great care with his hair, using a lot of gel to sculpt it into place, and he'd been quite adorably serious, even when he was drunk. They were often drunk in those early days. His gravity used to make Cecilia feel girly and giggly. They'd been together for ages before he'd revealed the lighter side. The boy, she read, was Peter Fechter, an 18-year-old bricklayer who was one of the first people to die trying to escape the Berlin Wall. He was shot in the pelvis and fell back into the death strip on the eastern side, where he took an hour to bleed to death. Hundreds of witnesses on both sides watched, but nobody offered him medical assistance, although some people threw him bandages. "For heaven's sake," said Cecilia crossly, and pushed the book away. What a thing for Esther to read, to know that such things were possible. Cecilia would have helped that boy. She would have marched straight out there. She would have called for an ambulance. She would have shouted, "What's wrong with you people?" Who knew what she would have done, really? Probably nothing if it meant the risk of being shot herself. She was a mother. She needed to be alive. Death strips were not part of her life. Nature strips? Shopping strips? She'd never been tested. She probably never would be tested. "Polly, you've been talking to him for hours. Dad is probably bored," yelled Isabel. Why must they always be yelling? The girls missed their father desperately when he was away. He was more patient with them than Cecilia, and right from when they were little, he'd always been prepared to be involved in their lives in ways Cecilia quite honestly couldn't be bothered. He played endless tea parties with Polly, holding tiny teacups with his little finger held out. He listened thoughtfully to Isabel talk on and on about the latest drama with her friends. It was always a relief for them all when John Paul came home. "Take the little darlings," Cecilia would cry, and he would, driving them off on some adventure, bringing them back hours later, sandy and sticky. "Daddy does not think I am boring," screamed Polly. "Give the phone to your sister right now," yelled Cecilia. There was a scuffle in the hallway, and Polly reappeared in the kitchen. She came and sat down at the table with Cecilia and put her head in her hands. Cecilia slid John Paul's letter in between the pages of Esther's book and looked at her 6-year-old daughter's beautiful little heart-shaped face. Polly was a genetic anomaly. John Paul was good-looking. A spunk, they used to call him. And Cecilia was attractive enough in low lighting. But somehow, they'd managed to produce one daughter who was in a different league altogether. Polly looked just like Snow White. Black hair, brilliant blue eyes, and ruby lips. Genuinely ruby lips. People thought she was wearing lipstick. Her two elder sisters with their ash blonde hair and freckled noses were beautiful to their parents, but it was only Polly who consistently turned heads in shopping centres. "Far too pretty for her own good," Cecilia's mother-in-law had observed the other day, and Cecilia had been irritated, but at the same time she'd understood. What did it do to your personality to have the one thing that every woman craved? Cecilia had noticed that beautiful women held themselves differently. They swayed like palm trees in the breeze of all that attention. Cecilia wanted her daughters to run and stride and stomp. She didn't want Polly to bloody sway. "Do you want to know the secret I told Daddy?" Polly looked up at her through her eyelashes. Polly would sway all right. Cecilia could see it already. "That's okay," said Cecilia. "You don't need to tell me."
The secret is that I've decided to invite Mr. Whidbey to my pirate party, said Polly.
Polly's seventh birthday was the week after Easter. Her pirate party had been a popular topic of conversation for the last month.
Polly, said Cecilia, we've talked about this.
Mr. Whidbey was the PE teacher at St. Angela's, and Polly was in love with him. Cecilia didn't know what it said about Polly's future relationships that her first crush was a man who appeared to be about the same age as her father. She was meant to be in love with teenage pop stars, not a middle-aged man with a shaved head. It was true that Mr. Whidbey had something. He was very broad-chested and athletic-looking, and he rode a motorbike and listened with his eyes. But it was the school mums who were meant to feel his sex appeal, which they certainly did. Cecilia herself was not immune. Not his 6-year-old students.
"We're not asking Mr. Whidbey to your party," said Cecilia. "It wouldn't be fair. Otherwise, he'd feel like he had to come to everyone's parties."
"He'd want to come to mine."
"No."
"We'll talk about it another time," said Polly airily, pushing her chair back from the table.
"We won't," Cecilia called after her.
But Polly had sauntered off. Cecilia sighed. "Well, lots to do." She stood and pulled John Paul's letter from Esther's book. First, she would file this damned thing. He said he'd written it just after Isabel was born, and that he didn't remember exactly what it said. That was understandable. Isabel was 12, and John Paul was often so vague. He was always relying on Cecilia to be his memory. It was just that she was pretty sure he'd been lying.
Chapter 5.
"Maybe we should break in."
Liam's voice pierced the silent night air like the shriek of a whistle.
"We could smash a window with a rock. Like, for example, that rock right there. See, Mum, look, see. Can you see?"
"Shh," said Tess. "Keep your voice down." She banged the door knocker over and over. Nothing. It was 11 o'clock at night, and she and Liam were standing at her mother's front door. The house was completely dark, the blinds drawn. It looked deserted. In fact, the whole street seemed eerily silent. Was no one up watching the late news? The only light came from a street light on the corner. The sky was starless, moonless. The only sound was a single plaintive cicada, the last survivor of summer, and the soft sigh of far-off traffic. She could smell the sweet perfume of her mother's gardenias. Tessa's mobile phone had run out of battery. She couldn't call anyone, not even a taxi to take them to a hotel. Maybe they would have to break in. But Tessa's mother had become so security conscious over the last few years. Didn't she have an alarm now? Tess imagined the sudden whoop-whoop of an alarm shattering the neighborhood. "I can't believe this is happening to me." She hadn't thought it through. She should have called to let her mother know that they were coming, but she'd been in such a state, booking the flight, packing, getting to the airport, finding the right gate, Liam trotting alongside her, talking the whole time. He was so excited. He wouldn't shut up the whole flight. And now he was so exhausted, he was virtually delirious. He thought they were on a rescue mission to help Grandma. "Grandma has broken her ankle," Tess had told him, "so we're going to stay and help her for a little while."
"What about school?" he'd asked.
"You can miss a few days of school," she'd told him, and his face had lit up like a Christmas tree. She hadn't mentioned anything about attending a new school. Obviously. Felicity had left, and while Tess and Liam packed, Will had slunk about the house, pale and sniffing.
When they were alone, and she was throwing clothes into a bag, he'd tried to talk to her, and she'd turned on him, like a cobra rising to strike, hissing through clenched, crazy teeth, "Leave me alone!" "I'm sorry," he said, taking a step backwards. "I'm so sorry." He and Felicity must have used the word sorry about 500 times by now. "I promise you," said Will, lowering his voice, presumably so Liam wouldn't overhear. "If there's any doubt in your mind, I want you to know that we never slept together."
"You keep saying that, Will," she said. "I don't know why you think that makes it better. It makes it worse. It never occurred to me that you would sleep together. Like, thank you so much for your restraint. I mean, for God's sake."
Her voice trembled. "I'm sorry," he said again, and wiped the back of his hand across his nose. Will had behaved perfectly normally in front of Liam. He'd helped him find his favourite baseball cap under his bed, and when the cab had arrived, he'd got down on his knees and half-cuddled, half-wrestled him in that rough, loving way of fathers with their sons. Tess had seen exactly how Will had managed to keep this thing with Felicity a secret for so long. Family life, even with just one little boy, had its own familiar rhythms, and it was perfectly possible to keep right on dancing like you always had, even when your mind was somewhere else. And now, here she was, stranded in this sleepy little North Shore suburb of Sydney with a delirious 6-year-old.
"Well," she said carefully to Liam, "I guess we should..."
"What? Wake up a neighbour? Risk the alarm?"
"Wait," said Liam.
He put a finger to his lips. His big eyes were pools of shining blackness in the dark.
"I think I hear something from inside."
He pressed his ear to the front door. Tess did the same.
"Hear it?"
She did hear something, a strange rhythmic thumping sound from overhead.
"It must be Grandma's crutches," said Tess.
Her poor mother. She'd probably been in bed. Her bedroom was right at the other end of the house. Bloody Will, bloody Felicity, dragging her poor crippled mum out of bed. When exactly had this thing between Will and Felicity started? Was there an actual moment where something changed? How could she have missed it? She saw them together every single day of her life, and she'd never noticed a thing. Felicity had stayed for dinner last Friday night. Maybe Will had been a little quieter than usual. Tess had thought it was because his back was playing up. He'd been tired. They'd all been working so hard. But Felicity had been in fine form, luminous even. Tess had caught herself staring a few times. Felicity's beauty was still so new, and it made everything about her beautiful. Her laugh, her voice. Yet Tess hadn't been wary. She'd been stupidly secure of Will's love. Secure enough to wear her old jeans with the black T-shirt that Will said made her look like a bikey chick. Secure enough to tease him for his mild grumpiness. He'd whacked her bottom with the tea towel when they were cleaning up the kitchen afterwards. They hadn't seen Felicity on the weekend, which was unusual. She'd been busy, she said. It had been rainy and cold. Tess and Will and Liam had watched TV, played Snap, made pancakes together. It had been a good weekend, hadn't it? It occurred to her that Felicity was luminous on Friday night because she was in love. The door swung open and light flooded the hallway.
"What in the world?"
said Tess's mother. She was wearing a blue quilted dressing gown and leaning heavily on a pair of crutches, her eyes blinking myopically, her face dragged down with pain and effort. Tess looked down at her mother's white bandaged ankle and imagined her waking up, hauling herself out of bed, hobbling around trying to find her dressing gown, and then the crutches. "Oh, Mum," she said, "I'm so sorry." "Why are you sorry? What are you doing here?" "We've come," she began, but her throat closed up.
"To help you, Grandma," cried Liam, "because of your ankle. We flew here in the dark."
"Well, that's very lovely of you, my darling boy." Tessa's mother moved on her crutches to the side to let them in. "Come in. Come in. Sorry I took so long coming to the door. I had no idea crutches were so damn tricky. I imagined myself swinging jauntily along, but they dig into your armpits like I don't know what. Liam, go turn on the light in the kitchen, and we'll have some hot milk and cinnamon toast."
"Cool."
Liam headed towards the kitchen, and for some inexplicable 6-year-old boy reason, began moving his arms and legs jerkily like a robot.
"I compute, I compute, affirmative, to cinnamon toast."
Tess carried their bags inside. "Sorry," she said again, as she put them down in the hallway and looked up at her mother. "I should have called. Is your ankle very painful?"
"What happened?" said her mother.
"Nothing."
"Rubbish."
"Will," she began, and stopped.
"My darling girl." Her mother lurched about alarmingly as she tried to reach for her without losing hold of the crutches. "Don't break another bone."
Tess steadied her. She could smell her mother's toothpaste, her face cream and soap, and beneath it all, that familiar, musky, musty mum smell. On the hallway wall behind her mother's head was a framed photo of herself and Felicity at 7 years old, in their white lacy communion dresses and veils, their palms piously pressed together at the center of their chests in the traditional first communion pose. Auntie Mary had an identical photo in the same spot in her hallway. Now, Felicity was an atheist, and Tess described herself as lapsed.
"Hurry up and tell me," said Lucy.
"Will..." Tess tried again. And she couldn't finish.
"Felicity," supplied her mother. "Am I right?"
"Yes." She lifted one elbow and thumped a crutch hard against the floor so that the first communion photo rattled.
"The little bitch."
1961. The Cold War was at its iciest. Thousands of East Germans were fleeing for the West. "No one has any intention of building a wall," announced East Germany's Chancellor, Walter Ulbricht, described by some as Stalin's robot. People looked at each other with raised eyebrows. "What the? Who said anything about a wall?" Thousands more packed their bags. In Sydney, Australia, a young girl called Rachel Fisher sat on the high wall overlooking Manly Beach, swinging her long, tanned legs, while her boyfriend, Ed Crowley, flipped through the Sydney Morning Herald, annoyingly engrossed. There was an article in the paper about the developments in Europe, but neither Ed nor Rachel had much interest in Europe. Finally, Ed spoke. "Hey, Rach, why don't we get you one of those?" he said, and pointed at the page in front of him. Rachel peered over his shoulder without much interest. The paper was open on a full-page advertisement for Angus and Coote. Ed's finger was on an engagement ring. He grabbed her elbow just before she toppled off the wall onto the beach. They were gone. Rachel was in bed, with the television on, the Woman's Weekly in her lap, a cup of Earl Grey tea on the bedside table, along with the flat cardboard box of macarons that Lauren had brought along tonight. Rachel should have offered them around at the end of the night, but she'd forgotten. It may have been deliberate. She could never be sure just how much she disliked her daughter-in-law. It was possible she hated her.
"Why not go on your own to New York, my dear girl? Get 2 years' worth of Lauren time."
Rachel slid the cardboard tray onto the bed in front of her and examined the 6 garishly coloured biscuits. They didn't look that special to her. Supposedly, they were the latest thing amongst people who cared about the latest things. These ones were from a shop in the city where people lined up for hours to buy them. Fools. Did they have nothing better to do? Although it seemed unlikely that Lauren had lined up for hours. After all, Lauren had better things to do than everyone. Rachel had a feeling there might have been a story about the procurement of the macarons, but she didn't really listen when Lauren was speaking about anything that didn't involve Jacob. She selected a red one and took a tentative bite.
"Oh, God!"
she moaned a moment later and thought, for the first time in she didn't know how long, of sex. She took a bigger bite.
"Mother Mary!"
She laughed out loud. No wonder people lined up for them. It was exquisite. The raspberry flavour of the creamy centre was like the barest touch of fingertips on her skin. The meringue, light and tender, like eating a cloud.
"Wait, who said that?"
"It's like eating a cloud, Mummy."
An entranced little face. Janie, about 4 years old, her first taste of fairy floss at Luna Park, a church fete. Rachel couldn't zoom back her memory. It was focused only on Janie's shining face and her words,
"Like eating a cloud, Mummy."
Janie would have loved these macarons. Without warning, the biscuit slipped from Rachel's fingers and she hunched over as if she could duck the first punch. But it was too late. It had her. It had been a long time since it had been as bad as this. A wave of pain. As fresh and shocking as that first year when she woke up each morning and for one instant she forgot, before she was punched in the face with the realization that Janie wasn't in the room down the hallway, spraying herself with too much sickly impulse deodorant, pasting orange makeup over her perfect 17-year-old skin, dancing to Madonna. The almighty towering injustice of it tore and twisted her heart like contractions. My daughter would have loved these silly biscuits. My daughter would have had a career. My daughter could have gone to New York. A steel vice wrapped around her chest and squeezed so she felt like she was suffocating and she gasped for air. But beneath her panic, she could hear the weary, calm voice of experience. "You've been here before. It won't kill you. It feels like you can't breathe, but you actually are breathing. It feels like you'll never stop crying, but you actually will." Finally, little by little, the vice around her chest loosened its grip enough for her to breathe again. It never went away completely. She'd accepted that a long time ago. She'd die with the clamp of grief still gripping her chest. She didn't want it to go away. That would be like Janie had never existed. She was reminded of those Christmas cards the first year. "Dear Rachel, Ed and Rob, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year." It was as if they'd just closed up the space where Janie had been. And Merry? Were they out of their silly little minds? She'd sworn each time she'd opened another card, ripping it into tiny pieces.
"Mum, give them a break. They just don't know what else to say," Rob had said to her tiredly. He'd been just 15, and his face had seemed to belong to a sad, pale 50-year-old with acne.
Rachel swept the macaron crumbs off the sheets with the back of her hand. "Crumbs! Christ almighty, look at these crumbs," Ed would have said. He thought eating in bed was immoral. Also, if he could see the television sitting there on the chest of drawers, he'd have a fit. Ed believed that people who had televisions in their bedroom were akin to cocaine addicts, weak, debauched types. The bedroom, according to Ed, was for a prayer on your knees next to the bed, your head resting on your fingertips, lips moving rapidly, very rapidly. He didn't believe in wasting too much of the big guy's time. Followed by sex, preferably every night, followed by sleep. She picked up the remote and pointed it at the television, flicking through the channels. A documentary about the Berlin Wall. No, too sad. One of those crime investigation shows? Never. A family sitcom. She left it there for a moment, but it was a husband and a wife shouting at each other, and their voices were horrible and high-pitched. Instead, she switched it over to a cooking show and turned the sound down. Ever since she'd been living alone, she'd gone to bed with the television on. The comforting banality of the murmuring voices and flickering images warded off the feeling of terror that could sometimes overwhelm her. She lay on her side and closed her eyes. She slept with the lights on. After Janie died, she and Ed couldn't stand the dark. They couldn't go to sleep like normal people. They had to trick themselves and pretend that they weren't going to sleep. Behind her closed eyelids, she saw Jacob toddling along a New York street, wearing his little denim overalls, crouching down with his fat little hands on his knees to examine the steam billowing out of the vents in the road. Was that steam hot? Had she been crying for Janie before, or had she really been crying for Jacob? All she knew was that once they took him from her, life would go back to being unendurable. Except, and this was the worst part, she would, in fact, endure it. It wouldn't kill her. She'd keep on living day after day after day, an endless loop of glorious sunrises and sunsets that Janie never got to see. "Did you call for me, Janie?" That thought was always like the tip of a knife twisting and turning at her very core. She'd read somewhere that wounded soldiers begged for morphine and their mothers as they died on the battlefield. The Italian soldiers especially. "Mamma mia," they called. In a sudden movement that wrenched her back, Rachel sat up and hopped out of bed in Ed's pajamas. She'd started wearing them straight after he died and never stopped. They didn't really smell of him anymore, but she could almost imagine that they did. She got down on her knees next to her chest of drawers and pulled out an old photo album with a soft, faded green vinyl cover. She sat back up on the bed and slowly flipped the pages. Janie laughing. Janie dancing. Janie eating. Janie sulking. Janie with her friends. Including him.